Benvenuti ad Alma Lectio, il podcast dell'Università di Bologna dedicato alle Lectio Magistralis tenute da scienziati, intellettuali e personaggi illustri che nel corso degli anni sono stati invitati dall'Università di Bologna a condividere il loro sapere e contribuire alla divulgazione della conoscenza. Nella puntata di oggi ascoltiamo Umberto Eco, saggista, intellettuale, semiologo, filosofo, scrittore, traduttore, bibliofilo e medievista italiano. Why the Universities è il testo pronunciato il 20 settembre 2013 nell'Aula Magna di Santa Lucia dell'Università di Bologna in occasione delle celebrazioni per i 25 anni della Magna Carta Universitatum. Buon ascolto!
Rector, dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you can follow me because no pun intended, but there is an exaggerated echo here in this room. Anyway, I had many beautiful things to say about the Magna Carta, but the rector came before me and he said everything he had to say, and so I cut and I go to the core of my speech. In spite of the fact that frequently mass media question the role of university in a world where the web seems to be on the verge of taking the place of old educational institutions, I think that the function of universities is more relevant today than yesterday. We are living in an historical moment in which, even though the European Union has been established after a long time, from many countries of the European community, there is a people doubting if the fact of having established an economical unity based on a common money is enough to design and support the idea of a European identity. I would like to remember that the very idea of a possible European identity was born in 1088. With the birth of the first university of the Western world. At that time, Europe was only a geographical expression, used maybe by Herodotus, designing the central portion of the known universe, certainly better known than the still fabulous lands of Asia and Africa, but without political or cultural value. There was the Holy Roman Empire, represented by, at that time, by Frederick Barbarossa. There was the Roman Church. There were kingdoms in France and England ferociously competing each other. Small Christian kingdoms in Spain fighting against the Arabic dominion. The first maritime republics and the first independent cities in Italy. The first nucleus of a Hanseatic League, all separated by different interests and languages, and united only by a single vehicular language, the medieval Latin, spoken, however, only by cultivated persons. It was just on the basis of that cultural pidgin that was Latin that universities were born, representing the only case of a peaceful migration of learned scholars and students wandering as clerici vagantes from university to university, from city to city, from nation to nation, so that one could find in the following centuries foreigners like Erasmus, Copernicus, Geoffroy de Vinsauf, Paracelsus, or Dürer in Bologna, and Italians like Bonaventure and Thomas Aquinas in Paris, all were speaking the same language. The problems debated by the Averroists in Bologna were the same debated by the schoolmen of the Sorbonne, and the Franciscans from Oxford and Marsilius of Padua was talking with William of Ockham and John of Jandun about political questions that were crucial for the German Empire. Thus, the universities represented the first nucleus of a future European identity. And Europe, through the university, tended to be uniquely a geographical expression to become a cultural community. And even when we think of today globalization, and globalization is represented in this room. Globalization, which is certainly the result of many political, military, scientific, technological developments, we should not forget that it was also through the university's network that Fermi and his Italian companion brought the result of their scientific research in the USA, as well as Einstein, represented a fusion of European and American scientific experience from the universities of Bern, Berlin, and Princeton. I think that these short remarks are enough to answer the question, why university? During the last 900 years, they have been the crucible of an international identity and of the most creative episodes of Western culture. Can they still have a role in our present global world? First of all, let me resort to a biblical quotation. In the book of Kings, 1:19, when Elias was in the cave of the Mount Horeb, and he was called forth to stand before the Lord, a mighty strong wind went from the mountains and break the rocks, said, "Non invento Dominus," says the Vulgata translations. The Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind came a commotion of the earth and air, but not in commotione, not in commotione Dominus. The Lord was not in the commotion. And after the commotion came fire, but not in igne Dominus. The Lord was not in the fire. God cannot be found in noise. God shows up only in silence. God is never in the mass media. God is never in the first pages of the newspapers. God is never on TV. God is never on Broadway. God is where there is no agitation. The maxim obviously holds even for those who do not believe in God, but think that there is somewhere some truth to be discovered or some new value to be created. Truth and creativity cannot be found in commotion, but rather in a silent research. In the turmoil of the present world, together with the places of religious meditation, the only other places of silence remain and still are the universities. They still are among the few homes where rational confrontation between different worldviews can be implemented. We, university people, are supposed to fight without mortal weapons, an unending battle for the advancement of learning and of human compassion. I am not so naive to forget that knowledge can automatically bring peace and piety, because it happened in the history that people who loved Brahms or Goethe were able to organize concentration camps. But those people, before realizing their final solution, had to kick out of the university every critical mind. A university was always, and it is, always a risk for every kind of dictatorship. Frequently, many sides of the academia were supporting colonialism, racism, intolerance. But it was, however, in the milieu of Western university and learned society that the modern world invented that new approach to cultures and civilizations called cultural anthropology. It was because of the studies of the cultural anthropologists of the 19th century, but following ideas already suggested by Montaigne and Locke and the philosophers of the Enlightenment, that we learned that there are no other culture, that there are other cultural models, organic in themselves, that ought to be recognized, understood in their internal logic and respected. Cultural anthropology, by substituting the culture of culture to the one of race, worked deeply in order to make each of us more aware of the plurality of cultures and of the right of every culture to survive. Cultural anthropology did not change the world, while anthropologists were teaching us how to recognize and respect different cultural behaviors, different religions and ethnic habits. The Western world produced the protocols of the elders of science, while the early mass media, from the popular novels to the Hollywood movies, encouraged the vision of the bad other, the ferocious Indian, the stupid Negro destined to a fate of eternal slavery by his irremediable inferiority, the pigtailed Chinese, and so on. But at the same time, these clichés were dismantled just within the academic milieu. Universities are still the places where mutual confrontation and discussion, better ideas for a better world, as well as the reinforcement and defense of the basic universal values, can be found, and not shelved in a library, but spread around with every possible means. University as a peace force. What a beautiful idea. And it would be enough to think of the Erasmus project for forcing a new international network of clerici vagantes, frequently, my friends, marrying each other, and so preparing at least for Europe a new generation of bilingual citizens incapable to be seduced by any form of chauvinism. But let me also quote about the present duties of a university today, two endeavors that are, in my opinion, urgent and fundamental. We are frequently told that one of the risks people nurtured by mass media and the young generation in particular are running is a crisis of historical memory. Without memory, there is no survival. Societies have always relied on memory in order to preserve their own identity, beginning with the old man of the tribe who, seated under a tree in the evenings, told the stories about the exploits of his ancestors. And when some acts of censorship wiped out a section of a society's memory, the society undergoes an identity crisis. In this sense, universities are still the place where common memories can be stocked and preserved. But memory is not only a stock, it's also a filter. Historical memory is not only made by what we think it's important to remember, but also by what we think it's important to forget. One of the functions of social and cultural memory is also to act as a strainer. A culture, as historical memory, is not only a stock of data, it's also the result of their percolation. It represents our ability in throwing away everything we do not consider useful or necessary. The history of civilizations is made up with millions of data which have been buried. Frequently, we have discovered that such a process was a loss, and we need centuries to retrieve lost information. Our Greek ancestors had forgotten the Egyptian mathematics, and the Middle Ages had forgotten a great part of the Greek science. Likewise, we have by now forgotten the meaning of the statues of the Easter Island, and many of the tragedies quoted by Aristotle in his Poetics are definitely lost. However, in spite of these undesirable accidents, a culture must eliminate a lot of information. Which were the names of all the soldiers fighting at Waterloo? What happened to Calpurnia, Caesar's wife, after the Ides of March? Culture has eliminated this data in order not to overload our historical memory. By the way, this process of cancellation not only holds for cultures, but also for our personal life. Jorge Luis Borges wrote a beautiful story, Funes el Memorioso, on a character who remembered everything, every leaf he saw in his childhood, every word he heard in the course of his life, every murmur of wind he felt on his skin, every sentence he read. Just because of such total memory, Funes was an idiot, paralyzed by his inability to filter and to throw away the result of his experiences. Our unconscious works because it removes. If there is something disturbs us, we ask our psychoanalyst to retrieve what we removed because it was too embarrassing. But it was important to eliminate all the rest, and our soul is the product of such a selective memory. If we had fullness memory, we would be animals without soul, that is, without identity. Our identity is made not only by what we remember, but also by what we succeed in forgetting. Nevertheless, a culture doesn't only encourage individuals to forget what they should dismiss as useless, but frequently, a culture conceals what they should remember. Such is the role of various forms of censure until the damnatio memoriae. But the culture can censure not only by delation and silence, but also by an excess of information. I have once written, it was a paradox, but as every paradox, the bearer of some truth, that there was a little difference between the Stalinist Pravda and the Sunday New York Times. The Pravda censured every undesired information. The Sunday Times amounts to 600 pages and certainly contains all the news that's fit to print. But nobody can read these 600 pages in the course of a week. And we risk to be submerged by an excess of information. And there is a little difference between silence and too much noise. Certainly, as far as the Sunday Times is concerned, well-informed readers are able to select the relevant information, throwing in a basket the supplements that do not interest them, let's say the real estate, the sports, house and gardens, and even the books review. But what happens today with the excess of information represented by the World Wide Web? It is becoming similar to Funes' brain. Up to now, society filtered things out for us through textbooks and encyclopedias. With the web, all possible knowledge and information, even the least useful, is there at our disposal. Try to look in the web, let's say, about the Holocaust. There is no criterion for detecting at the first glance if a seat is made by a responsible historian or by a Nazi negationist group. Even though a learned person is able to detect the nature of the site, what will happen to untrained persons who for the first time search the web for some elementary notions on this event? The inability to filter out entails the impossibility to discriminate. Only universities and educational institutions at large can teach us how to select. A new art of decimation has to be invented and communicated. Otherwise, without any encyclopedia of unified science, everybody has the right to build up his or her own encyclopedia. We shall have a New Age encyclopedia, an Asian encyclopedia, an astrological encyclopedia, and so on and so forth. With such a fragmentation of knowledge, 7 billion inhabitants of this planet could produce 7 billion of different ideological selection procedures, 7 billion of different languages, incommunicable each other. The web may become a Babel Tower where people will speak not 70, but 7 billion of personal languages. The presence of universities can represent a guarantee for many young or old people. We are seeking for a reliable encyclopedia. A common encyclopedia is not the imposition of a unified thought. It is the common playground for checking and comparing any fruitful difference. Universities are the only place where a unified approach to diversity can be correctly implemented. But university, I also mean to provide for an excess of filtration. Cultures, or at least our Western culture, philologically oriented, are concerned with the possibility to retrieve data whose loss we consider a disgrace. This is why we need the work of specialists, historians or archaeologists, supposed to resurrect the notions and experience which by accident sank in the dark. In doing this, the collective memory is able to reemerge these data and puts them again, if not in the common encyclopedia, at least in some specialized one. In this way, a mature culture decides to put some information in a latency state. Exceeding information is thus, so to speak, deeply frozen, so that when it is necessary, experts can put them in an ideal microwave oven to revive it again, for instance, in order to decipher an old document newly discovered. The latency place are represented by the model of a library or of the archive as the indispensable containers of a wisdom that can be revisited even though it was not revisited for centuries. The university are thus not only the place of an indispensable filtration, but also, with their libraries and archives, the keepers of indispensable latent information. Let me in the end to quote the last reason why universities still play a fundamental role even in a world in the verge of becoming more and more virtual. The university are still one of the few places where people can meet face to face, where young people and scholars can realize that the advancement of learning needs real human and not virtual identities. Thank you.
Avete ascoltato Why the Universities, il testo pronunciato da Umberto Eco il 20 settembre 2013 nell'Aula Magna di Santa Lucia dell'Università di Bologna, in occasione delle celebrazioni per i 25 anni della Magna Carta Universitatum. Vi aspettiamo alla prossima Alma Lectio.